Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest, Michael Schellenberger. Michael's the best-selling author of San Francisco, Why Progressives Ruin Cities, and Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. He's an award-winning investigative journalist. He's broken major stories in so many areas, crime and drug policy, homelessness, climate change and the environment, and most recently, for his exposure of the Twitter files, he won the 2023 Dow Award for Journalism, given in partnership with the National Journalism Center. He now writes on a wide range of issues, covering free speech, censorship, as well as the environment. We have a conversation about those issues, and particularly how our media is functioning and what is their essential role in a free society to inform the public so the public can determine truth. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Michael Schellenberger, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Great to meet you. I'd like to start out sort of from the beginning with you. Your interest in being an investigative journalist, because I think this is so critical these days. I think we've learned how important the media is, how important journalism is, the ethical responsibility of journalism. I sort of took it all for granted in the past, and then we saw what happened, particularly exposed during COVID. So, like, what, you know, in a sense, I sort of wanted to start with, why did you even become interested in that sort of career, that sort of focus of your work?
Well, yeah, it's a funny story. If I don't know that anybody's really asked me about it, but I mean, my first journalism was when I was 15 years old in high school working for the student newspaper. But I was always much more of an activist. I was a very left-wing kid. I was on the radical left. I went and helped the Sandinistas in 1988. I went to Brazil because I was passionate about Lula and the Workers' Party. I then did campaigns for left-wing activist groups in the Bay Area from 19. Well, I went to grad school, dropped out because it was too abstract. It was anthropology, and it was really super abstract and disconnected from ordinary people's lives. I had spent a bunch of time doing research in the semi-Amazon in Brazil, and basically just quit to do various sort of media campaigns and publicity efforts for left-wing causes from 1996 until 2002. And then I became very alarmed about climate change. I've had two think tanks, Breakthrough Institute, which focused on the environment. And then I left in 2016 and started Environmental Progress. And now I have another nonprofit called Civilization Works. It's actually the same, it's a different name, slightly different mission. The reporting was never something, I mean, I would always write, and I did two books, Apocalypse Never in San Francisco, but I never identified as a journalist until really 3 years ago. It was really when I started making a living as a journalist, which was with my books and then with Twitter files. I was, Barry Weiss invited me to join her to do the investigative research on the Twitter files. In part, they knew my books, but her wife, Nellie Bowles, was out front of a supervised drug consumption site in San Francisco, and where I was being kicked out because I had gotten into the site. And the security guards have me, and I'm like arguing with them to give me my cameras back. And I think that sort of sealed it. They were like, okay, this is somebody that is sort of has an attitude of an investigative journalist, because there are things. I'm an entrepreneurial person, and entrepreneurs are characterized on the personality level by open-mindedness and somewhat disagreeable, meaning we don't go along to get along. We don't accept assumptions. And so those things work for an entrepreneur. They also are what you need to be a reporter.
What you need, but if I may interrupt, I'm not sure that, of the two, sort of unlikable and interested in sort of truth, I'm not sure that most journalists have both of those. I think of the ones I met in Washington, certainly have one of those, and it's not.
And I hope it doesn't mean disagreeable is not supposed to mean unlikable. I mean, I don't think I'm unlikable, but some people think I'm unlikable. But I think it's more like just willing to be like, I don't agree with that. you know.
No, that's very important. Yeah, skeptical. Yeah. And yeah. In the mode of skeptical, to seek the truth, to challenge authority, these are critical things. And I think, in my opinion, it doesn't just apply to journalists. It applies to all of us as individual citizens in what we hope to be a free society.
For sure.
You know, I want to, before I get into certain issues that you've actually explored and spent time on, I want to ask you about this idea of investigative reporting, truth seeking by journalism. And I always ask people this because I grew up in a very naive era, I think, pre-cable TV. We only had a few networks. We just assumed we were being told the truth, that news journalism, news reporting was to hold power accountable, to investigate, to seek the truth, to expose the truth. And my opinion is, of course, and I think many of us would agree, I think, that now... a lot of the role is persuasion, editorializing, advocacy, rather than giving the public information. So given that, A, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that change, if it is one, and really is it a change, or were we just under an illusion that we were hearing truth that wasn't as editorialized?
I think definitely the latter since World War II. So I'm actually writing about this for our next book, but I think the basic picture is 1776 to sometime in the early 20th century, it was just kind of a free-for-all, and that newspapers could publish, and the United States had the First Amendment, and the government didn't really try to do that much censorship. The worst censorship in the early 20th century were the crackdowns around the 20th century Sedition Act under Woodrow Wilson, and the persecution mostly of the left, of socialists, anarchists, communists, by Hoover and the FBI. And it was mostly, you know, like preventing people from going to meetings or arresting people because they were members of the socialist or communist parties. You then get to World War One, and, you know, Americans are traditional. I mean, the conventional view is that Americans are reluctant warriors. We didn't want to have an empire. We didn't want to do foreign wars. And so to get America to participate in World War One took some government propaganda. It took, I mean, obviously World War II, then you have Pearl Harbor, and that makes it a lot easier. But really, World War One is the moment where the U.S. government is finally like, we have to engage in propaganda to increase support for the war and maintain support for the war. Because Americans, I think, you know, we're just, here we are, you know, we're separated by two oceans, we're this continental power. I think, you know, people came here because they were escaping tyranny. And I think the intuition in the culture, and I think it's still there, by the way, was always like, why are we involving ourselves in foreign countries? It wasn't that British, you know, we're the greatest civilization ever and we need to expand, or the Romans, or this, you know, the past, you know, we didn't view ourselves as a global superpower in World War One or World War Two. So that propaganda had to take place. You get to 1947, and there's actually a very important essay, I just read it, The Engineering of Consent, by somebody named Edward Bernays, who's perceived as the founder of public relations. He's the nephew of Freud. So he writes this famous essay where he says, it was funny, we even said persuasion. He writes this very famous essay where he says that you have to persuade. He writes, the engineering of consent is the very essence of the democratic process, the freedom to persuade and suggest. So what he's saying here, and of course, you know, if you're a political scientist or a sociologist, you know that Max Weber teaches you that legitimacy, that having the state's actions be legitimate in the eyes of the public is the main event for any government. That's before they become democratic. The people have to feel like the government should be the government. The people that are ruling you deserve that role. Bernays is saying a democracy requires the same thing, but you can't be so heavy-handed about it. You have to use persuasion. Therefore, you have to use psychological techniques. So then I think that what happens then from World War II until really 2016, I would say, is you had a much more controlled information environment than anybody knew. I mean, even I was rereading Noam Chomsky, who's this famous left-wing anarchist professor at MIT, writes a book with Edward Herman that came out when I was in high school. I think it was 88 or something, or 87, called The Manufacturing of Consent. inspired by Bernays, but also Lippmann is the other major thinker here of the first 20th century. And they made two mistakes, I think. They exaggerated the impact of the big corporations on media. They did talk about the role of the State Department and the U.S. government. But then I think that they actually understated the role of the U.S. government over the media, over what was acceptable. And the U.S. government exercises that power in all of these different ways. They grant the spectrum space for television and radio. And then there's just this elaborate public relations think tank, you know, these organizations that are constantly briefing reporters, educating reporters, telling them what to write, telling them what not to write. And that's been going on for decades, and we really hadn't seen it. You know, you sort of knew it was there, but it was much more elaborate than we knew, and we were only able to figure out how elaborate it was thanks to really to the Twitter files and then to the related Facebook and other social media files.
Right. And I think a lot of what I said about the pandemic, the pandemic itself, it didn't really create the problems. These things were there. We were just now, everything's visible. A lot of things that we never understood or sort of allowed or weren't aware of were exposed, both in terms of government power, people, individual, qualities, the herd mentality of things. All these things were probably all there. The censorship was going on, and it just became so visible. And I think, in my own personal view, the visibility, the awareness, is what is necessary if we want to change it. I mean, I think that one area that this is, you know, you mentioned environmental work, and you know, you're called a quote environmental activist, which has all kinds of implications and inferences that can be made from that term. And I sort of wanted to start talking about that because you've written a lot of interesting stuff about something you call eco-anxiety and really the idea of the harms that are done to the public by both the message about the environment and climate and the consequences of the policies themselves that are not spoken about, you know, the unintended consequences. Even if you took which I generally do, I take the view that policies and interests are well intended typically. Okay, my naive idealistic person is not destroyed, and I do think that's true. But the unintended consequences are the policy, the messaging itself has unintended consequences. I'd like to start with the environment and the things that you've focused on pre-Twitter files, I think.
Sure. So, I mean, environment was really my focus for 20 years, really 2002 to 2020 and really 2022. I kept working on it. And it all culminated in a 2020 book called Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. A bunch of chapters debunking myths about climate change, plastics, meat, agriculture, industrialization. It basically argues that everything that environmentalists have argued is completely opposite of the reality, and that the Industrial Revolution is good. It pulls people out of natural areas. It replaces wood, you know, use and wild animal consumption with artificial substitutes that allow nature to return. All the environmental metrics are going in the right directions, declining pollution. CO2 is very close to peaking and declining, probably maybe another 10 years or so, depending on what we do. And then the other question is, why do environmentalists oppose all of the solutions that are the most important environmental solutions? Two of the most famous are nuclear power and natural gas.
Right, exactly.
They replace coal, which is much more polluting. And then even things like, you know, farmed fish is better to take pressure off of wild fish stocks. And yet environmentalists have boycotted farmed fish.
Which goes to so many areas. Again, I hate it. Not everything is about the pandemic, but it showed it so clearly that there is a denial of fact in the interest of sort of what's intuitively desirable or something, even contrary to the evidence. It is very frustrating for me as a person who was trained in sort of medical science as a background is that I never understood that, you know, it's shocking to me that people deny the obvious evidence in favor of what they want to believe.
Right.
And it's true in the, of course, as you're describing and as you've seen in the environment. And again, like there are harms from this. It's not just denial of evidence. I mean, that's the problem, really. In fact, this eco-anxiety term that you use, you could see it in the young people, which is even worse, I feel, for us because, you know, you're not as old as I am. But, you know, when I have kids in their 20s, that whole generation, it seems, is just really unhinged, certainly vocal, the vocal people are, about the environment.
Right. Yeah. And so then you kind of get to why are people advocating these wrong solutions? And those are, that's a very interesting question. And it's an empirical question in the sense that you can trace why do people advocate, for example, renewables rather than natural gas and nuclear. And so my book goes through all the reasons for that. Or in the case of COVID, why did, was there's this heavy emphasis on the vaccine rather than on just improving medical treatments? You know, and so and in our next book, we are going to do COVID because my co-author, Alex Gutentag, is a kind of famous COVID journalist. So, yeah, I mean, these are, you know, and you kind of said before, is it well-intentioned? Well, it's always well-intentioned in the sense that almost nobody gets up in the morning and says, I want to hurt people or I want to cause harm. On the other hand, on the environmental side, they were clearly motivated by an anti-human Malthusian agenda, which viewed humans as the problem and not as the solution. And they invented a whole set of terrible policies, including sterilization, the denial of development. Basically, they continue to try to deny Africa cheap energy, whether it's
hydro. Yeah, I mean, this is going on today. This is the sin, the moral catastrophe, in my view, one of many, and you know more about this than I do, but is as an outsider, I'm saying, to watch the highly developed affluent countries start saying to these poor countries, you cannot develop it, when we all know that cheap energy is the key to, you know, better human welfare, really, in so many ways.
Right. Yeah. So then you sort of say, where is that coming from? And then there's sort of, you know, there's financial, political, and psychological, and even spiritual arguments for it. I mean, one of the animating motivations for a lot of these self-destructive and I would say anti-civilization policies is a deep, there's a deep anti-human part in the environment side, but it has a religious quality. And so what we see, particularly on the left, because the left tends to be more secular and atheist, is the creation of a new religion, of politics as a new religion to replace religion. And so, and if you already have religion in that part of your brain that's providing spiritual meaning, then you don't have as much a desire to create the woke. Now, I'm oversimplifying for the purpose of the
But are you actually of the opinion, and many people are, that this kind of passion in terms of almost a religious fervor about some of these things is actually filling a void that
is
because of the extreme rejection that I see? I'm not a religious person, by the way. I'm not speaking from a religious, you know, we were all raised, my people in my generation, with some sort of religious, religion was not anathema as it is today in
right.
Christianity and all this stuff. And I feel it is under attack in the United States to a great extent. You think this kind of religious fervor, for lack of a better word, about some of these issues, like the environment, is really a replacement for something that's needed by people as a human need, a religion, something to believe in that passionately?
Yeah, and not only that, but we've done a taxonomy called a taxonomy of woke religion, where we go through various religious characteristics and traits, including, kind of an alternative divinity, an alternative soul. So if you take the environment, you know, you have an alternative apocalypse in the form of climate change. You have guilt from an original sin, whether that's the Industrial Revolution or the invention of farming, both can be found in the environmental discourse. With trans, you see the creation of an alternative soul. So the idea is that you have this inner gender soul that is your true self, that it's invisible, you can't measure it, it's like a soul, but it's your gender and it's separate from your physical body, it's separate from your physical sex, and for some people they're not aligned. We see guilt when it comes to race and indigenous people, and a kind of it's a kind of guilt that can never be repaid. You can never get redemption from it, because the crime of slavery and genocide, or if you're in Germany, the Holocaust, it's too much guilt, and so it weighs down on you. And then then you see it's also other parts of religion, the social control. It's a way to control people. But you see even in the superficial ways, the kneeling after Black Lives Matter. My neighbor has painted, I'm in Berkeley, so my neighbor has painted the names of all the Black people that were killed by the police on the front of her house. I mean, you've got all these names. And so you've got a kind of, which is almost Catholic, or it's a kind of representation of names, or it's like a kind of, memorial or cemetery. I was just interviewed a woman today who left the Democratic Party. She was a high-powered consultant. And in 2020, she wasn't allowed to criticize the ideas of people of color. She wasn't allowed to say, I don't agree with your idea, because you had to treat Black and brown people as gods, almost as divinities, right, who couldn't be wrong. All the taboos, there's right. So it's really the religious perspective.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, leaping toward the religion analogy. Now, I don't know. I'm naive about religion. I said I'm not very knowledgeable about religion. But there is, with this fervor, is a true demonization of opposition that we see on the climate stuff, on the Black Lives Matter, on the transgender. Anyone who voices something that questions that belief, that fervor, is really attempted. They try to destroy them. I mean, this happened to me with the COVID stuff. That was fear-induced to a great extent. That's a little bit different, but it's sort of similar. I wonder if that fits into the religion narrative, this demonization of all the non-believers.
100%, and it's also a characteristic of totalitarianism. So one characteristic of totalitarianism is this hunt for heretics and apostates. Apostates. I always put the accent on the wrong syllable. Apostates. Apostates are worse than the heretics, because they once saw the light and now they've been corrupted.
In fact, the totalitarian way is really to eliminate competing things like religion.
Yeah, because it's its own religion. So it's its own. So totalitarianism is a religion of politics. And so therefore it's always out to attack competitors. And it's very, very aggressive. I mean, all religions are aggressive and dogmatic and evangelical when they begin, in their early stages. And it's only after they become powerful and established that decadence sets in and they start to fall apart, in the same way that the pagan religions of Rome fell apart in the face of a growing, strengthening Christianity, which of course Constantine then embraced. So it's a cycle, and we're in a downward cycle, and a totalitarian movement has emerged out of the weakness and exhaustion of Western civilization, which was founded on Christianity and then the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's sort of, and I don't want to spend too much time on religion, but I do think it's a little bit, first of all, I think people need ties to higher order, to a higher calling. If you're living just for yourself, this sort of hedonistic thing, I'm not sure what you're doing. Sort of as a very, non-intellectual statement, I think that we all need to be having sort of something beyond ourselves. Otherwise, your life is sort of meaningless. But and people need the ties. I think religion, again, coming from the angle of someone who isn't religious, I see the positives of religion in the sense that it's a community. There is a moral, ethical sort of need for people, and I think it can be very good. And so then when we don't have the true religion and we replace it with something else, it shows the need for these higher callings. And I'm very concerned that it has been misplaced, if not for lack of a better word, into these causes like the environment and other things where there's a fervor that is just not like a typical religion, a person who goes and uses it for the community tie, for a basic foundational way to live, as opposed to a fervor. That's very different to me. You know, one thing I want to pick up on, you start talking about the environmental stuff and you in the books that you've written and all this, and you use the word debunking, and it seems like we're in a world where investigative journalism, truth-seeking, is now the main goal, and the main need is to debunk what has been drummed into our heads. I mean, I'm not sure that was ever the case. I mean, again, maybe I was naive when I was younger, but I don't remember sensing that you were being told propaganda, that you were being beaten into with a message that was false. And now everything is about debunking what we've been told.
Yeah, I mean, I think that so part of what happens after, so, you know, there's a really amazing history of the printing press. And one of the things about the printing press, it's invented in around 1450. For the first 100 years, the Catholic Church loved the printing press. They could print more Bibles, they would have more authority. But as soon as Martin Luther gets his hands on a printing press and condemns the Catholic priests as corrupt for selling indulgences, mostly that's what he was writing about, the Catholic Church panics and basically spends several hundred years trying to censor printing presses. And the printing presses are being moved around. They go to the Netherlands, they're hiding them. And it's exactly like what social media was. Social media, starting in like 2010, 2011, was this tool for the CIA and the US government to basically run Arab Spring operations to do regime change in the North Africa and Middle East. Then the color revolutions get people in the street in Eastern Europe. And they were like, great, this is working great. The US State Department, the government was very much on the side of free speech. They wanted free speech. Well, you get to 2016. I mean, watch what happens. It's Brexit. It's Trump. It's Duterte in the Philippines. 2 years later, it's Bolsonaro in Brazil. And the intelligence community and the deep state, meaning State Department, CIA, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and their intermediary organizations like Aspen Institute or Brookings Institution, they just freak out. Absolutely. It's just a gigantic freak out from 2016 really until now, where mostly the Democrats, but also never Trumpers and some moderate and sort of more centrist Republicans, counter populists, they say, we got to get control of the social media platforms. Now, I hasten to add that no reputable political scientist thinks that Trump won because of social media. The evidence is overwhelming. He won because he defeated his Republican opponents in the debates, and then he defeated Hillary Clinton in the debates, and also just there's a bunch of other reasons. But nobody really thinks that Twitter is why Trump was elected. Nonetheless,
in fact, there was some censoring of his campaign.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
On social media.
Yeah. And it's not even clear if that hurt or helped, because sometimes it can help. But clearly there's a reaction, a counter-populist reaction to, and they want to gain control of the social media platforms, and they're still trying to gain control.
Of course. Absolutely.
And so really that goes from 2016 until 2022, when Elon Musk invites in Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, and Michael Schellenberger and others, and we go through the Twitter files, and lo and behold, we discover, oh my gosh, it's not just a couple things. I mean, we discovered multiple operations, and I say operations meaning like this is military-grade censorship and what they call information operations, what most people would call disinformation operations. You might have said in the past public relations operations, but most of it's not public. It's behind the scenes. And it's at a level of sophistication that we didn't even understand at first. It took us a bunch of time. Mark Zuckerberg has since confirmed, for example, the disinformation operation around Hunter Biden's laptop. I'm very comfortable saying that I believe that the evidence shows that both the CIA and the FBI interfered in the 2020 election in multiple ways, most dramatically around the Hunter Biden laptop. And Mark Zuckerberg has confirmed that. And we have the evidence in the Twitter files. So the big picture is the populist revolution on the right inspired a counter-populist backlash from the deep state and the intelligence community. And now it's worldwide. And we see governing parties, governing coalitions, politicians, governments demanding intense censorship. Brazil, Europe, Australia. I mean, it's amazing how it's happening all across the world.
Yes, amazing and shocking. And in my view, very, very frightening. Because it doesn't have to be said to someone like you, but I don't see how you can even pretend to have a free society in that kind of mode. I'm completely shocked and frightened, not just that it exists, but I'm frightened that when you look at the polling, younger people particularly, they think it's good to censor. They actually think it's appropriate to stop this whole thing. I mean, let's talk about this, what you call the censorship industrial complex. This is a term that basically is sort of saying that there is an organized, I think, effort by the U.S. government with private companies, basically, including but not limited to social media, to stop ordinary Americans from free speech and to spread the information they want, what some people call disinformation. I think that, again, it brings me back to, was this always there? And we didn't have social media, of course, so it wasn't so easy to discover because everything is digital now and we can look back like the Twitter files and see what was done. And it was more subtle. But I wonder if it was really as new as we think.
Well, I mean, my view is that the U.S. government exercised enormous control over what was allowed, particularly on foreign policy. Now, the Democratic Party also has had a robust, what they call it, public interest networks, where they basically have also then influenced government agencies, which then also are involved in this kind of information operations. But yeah, I mean, I think there was a huge amount of control that just suddenly spirals out of control. And really, it's happening earlier. It's happening in the 2010s. But you start to see this right-wing political success in 2016. Now, remember, we said censorship industrial complex is a reference to President Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address.
Sure.
He warns against the power of the military industrial complex. What does that mean? People still don't quite understand it. What he's specifically referring to is the ability of think tanks funded by the government and by military contractors to take the U.S. to war, to basically bring the United States into wars that it shouldn't be fighting. I mean, this is Eisenhower. Nobody's more credible than Eisenhower to make this case. 1961. The next key moment here is really the Pentagon Papers of 1969. 8 years later, the New York Times and Washington Post published the Pentagon Papers, which show that the U.S. military knew that they were losing the war in Vietnam for the preceding 8 years. You know, that information, and it's interesting, it was a guy from the military industrial complex who released those documents, a guy that worked at Rand Corporation, which is a big military contractor,
yes,
who releases the documents. You then get a beautiful moment, which is then you get Watergate a couple of years later. The Supreme Court rules in 71 in favor of the freedom of the press for the Pentagon Papers. You then get Watergate. And then in 75, you get the Church Committee hearings, which describes all of these, you know, bad behaviors by the intelligence community. And I will also, another point is that the media's, the public's trust in the media is like at an all-time high, I believe in like 79, and it's just gone down from them. When like 70% of the public, you know, All the President's Men has come out as a movie, I think in the late 70s, based on the famous Woodward Bernstein expose of Watergate. So journalists are like heroes. They're at the high point late 70s, it's like 70% support. Now it's 31%, and it's only been going down. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the media, like this system kind of goes into crisis a bit with the Vietnam War and, you know, and the media start to kind of get some more independence. Now, you know, it's uneven because then you get, you know, support for, you know, the New York Times famously supports, you know, the Iraq invasion in 2002, 2003, based on misinformation from the CIA, you know, a very famous case there. So it doesn't, the social media doesn't really start to destabilize things really again until the 2010s. 2010 to 2020, the media and the government all feel like they're all good. We control Twitter, we control Facebook, we're having, you know, then Trump wins and there's just a collective freak out from the deep state, the Democrats,
yeah,
and the mainstream news media who want to decide what people are allowed to say on social media. They think they should be able to because they are the truth. They're the truthful ones. They're the ones doing the fact checking.
I mean, I think what's fascinating on so many, there's so many parts, but one is to me, the role of social media. I think we all anticipated the media, the social media platforms and the internet in general as a way that, wow, we're going to see like so much free information. The free exchange of ideas is the ultimate now. The ideal sort of what was supposed to be the roles of universities and really the media, is, which of course we've seen is not. But the social media then, in my view, became an easy tool to censor and to spread whatever the information, because you could actually see what people were saying and you could tilt what the public square was sort of broadcasting in a way that I don't think anyone, unless I was alone in my being naive, I'd really anticipate it, that it would actually become a problem. Now, my personal view, though, is that the only solution to misinformation is more information. And I believe that because I'm not interested in censoring people. No one knows what truth is. No one should be trusted to define what truth is. The biggest purveyor of misinformation during the pandemic was the government and the CDC. We certainly cannot trust anyone. I think, in fact, it's good that there's less trust in many ways. I think we need to sort of grow up as human beings, as adults, and understand that we need to have the responsibility of critical thinking. And the only way we can even learn critical thinking is to hear different views. I mean, I say this all the time on campuses. So I think that the idea that somehow the solution of misinformation or disinformation or whatever these terms are meant to be, which really are just weaponizing words, the solution is somehow censorship and it's dangerous. That's absolutely the opposite of what I believe. I don't know where I assume I know where you sit on that, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, that's what the Supreme Court has ruled. I mean, this is not. You know, there's a new book called Liar in a Crowded Theater by Jeff Kosef, who's a constitutional law professor at Naval Academy. He goes through 100 years of Supreme Court rulings, and they're very clear about this. I don't think most Americans don't realize how much the Supreme Court and the First Amendment have protected the right to lie, to actually lie about. I mean, politics wouldn't exist if, you know, politicians lie all the time. So, what the Supreme Court said very explicitly in Sullivan versus New York Times, which was a lawsuit from the mid 60s around an advertisement, actually, it was a Martin Luther King advertisement that had misinformation in it, wrong information. And the Supreme Court said just what you said. They said the way to address misinformation is through free speech. Sometimes people say counter speech, but it's just more speech. And I mean, I would even go further. It's the only way to confront misinformation. In other words, if you're actually worried about misinformation and you're worried that people will believe wrong things, the only way to address that is with counter speech. Because if you censor it, then nobody ever learns the reality of it. Nobody ever learns the truth of it.
But here we're in a world where the people who want the censorship believe that their view of truth, whatever it is the only way, the only important information. I mean, I think that this whole concept, I just, again, I'm from a university environment. I'm from a background myself where, you know, question authority, listen, and then push back. Because if you don't question, you can never find out. You should never, by the way, be afraid of the question of your statement. You know, if you can't win on the data, I always say that the reason that these lockdowners needed to demonize people against lockdowns was because they couldn't win on the data. So they had to make the public believe that the other view was, you know, so-called dangerous. You know, I'm still concerned, though, you know, particularly when you see countries like Brazil and the emergence. I mean, it's sort of funny, ironic that you used to be a supporter of the Lula sort of world of governance when he first came in. And I understand that sort of intuitive attraction. But when you get people in power, their goal, in my view, in a very cynical view, is the number one goal of people in power is to maintain power. It's actually quite simple. And so we need to diffuse and to have a check on their power. And the check on the power is individual power. Freedom is the check on that kind of power. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas, part one of today's discussion with our guest Michael Schellenberger. And stay tuned for part two.